All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Nomad Strength Show. We've got a really fun episode for you today. I'm sitting down with Jeff Hairston. And Jeff and I have followed each other for, I don't know, a little under a year now. But we have so much crossover in the things that we enjoy, the hobbies that we have, the things that we like to do, the friends that we have. It was just kind of like we need to just sit down and finally talk and do a podcast together. So that's exactly what we did. And we were able to cover a ton of ground. Jeff has a lot of experience in a lot of areas that are things, again, that I'm really into and really interested in. So we went all the gamut of traditional archery, jiu-jitsu, strength training. We actually opened the whole thing talking about pregnancy for like almost 10 minutes because he's about to have their first child any second now, basically. And so we ended up talking about that for a few minutes too. We did everything. So it was a really fun conversation. He has a lot of really great insight when it comes to these things that we talked about. So it was just a fun conversation to have. And before we get into the episode itself, I wanted to make sure I let you guys know about a couple of the brands and the partners that we have here on the podcast, so you guys can check them out and support the people that support this show. Because without you guys listening, for sure the show wouldn't exist. But really, without the partnerships that we've developed, it's really going to be something cool here in the coming months that we're able to put out some cool stuff for you guys. And the first of those is Steady Grounds Coffee Company. This is a coffee company run and founded by a good friend of mine, George Adams, and his wife, CT. And it's all, every bag they make is fresh and made to, and roasted to order, every bag. And it is awesome. And on that front, I'm gonna drop a little bit of a tease for you guys, but we are working on a Nomad roast that will be specifically for this show, and I am so pumped about it. I'm getting stuff to taste this week sometime of some of the things that we're concocting and trying to make an awesome, awesome bag of coffee that you guys can have it be a Nomad roast. And it's gonna be a really cool thing that we're doing with George and I. And so Steady Grounds Coffee Company, go check them out. It's amazing coffee. Like I said, every bag is roasted to order. And it's awesome. It's literally some of the best coffee I've ever had in my entire life. And I've tried, you guys know I'm a coffee snob, and I'm not just saying this. I wouldn't have gone into stuff with a friend of mine if he wasn't actually making the best stuff I've had. So please go check him out. Follow them on Instagram. I'll put their links down in the show notes also. And then the other one I wanted to mention is Drew Kohlhofer and the family at Selway Archery. And we had Drew on the podcast a couple of months back, which is a great episode. I would encourage you to go back and listen to that if you haven't yet. But they make quivers for traditional bows, recurve longbows, self bows, all that kind of stuff. And I have one that has the Nomad Strength, the kettlebell bearded logo right on the front that he laser engraves into the rawhide. They do plastic hoods, they do rawhide hoods. You can laser engrave and customize them however you want. And they're incredibly high quality. But not only that, they do so much for the archery and the hunting and the outdoors and the conservation communities in general. And again, he's just a good friend and a good guy, and I want to support him as well. So please go check out Selway Archery if you're in need of a quiver. They have, again, incredibly high quality stuff. Go check them out, and that'll do it. So no other updates on as far as I'm concerned. So let's dive right into this episode with Jeff Hairston. Welcome back to the Nomad Strength Show, everybody. I am joined by Jeff Hairston today, and we were just kind of laughing before we hopped on how ever since I followed Jeff, I don't know, it's probably been a little under a year now, I would imagine, but every time I find something else out about Jeff, it's the stepbrothers, did we just become best friends moment kind of thing, where there's so much overlap in like the things that we enjoy and the things that we do, and you made the reference to one of the quotes that Bert Soren always says, you know, like the longer you do this kind of stuff, you end up finding the people that are always like you or have similar interests or like kind of you narrow down the thing. And it's totally what it is. So we're going to have a ton of stuff that we have the ability to get into. But we're also in a significant, like an interesting situation with this recording, because you're in full time, like could be any second now, baby watch mode. And so this episode could go the full length. It could go 14 minutes and then we might have to cut it. So this could be a short episode. It could not be, but we'll just take it as it goes and see how it goes. But man, thanks for making time. I'm pumped to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm so excited. It's really cool. I was thinking about it as we talked about before we started recording. It's like, oh, what are we going to talk about? And I'm like, gosh, this is really cool. We could talk about our love for music, jiu-jitsu, archery and hunting, strength training, all that type of stuff. And yeah, like you said, I'm on paternity family bonding right now. My wife is 3 days past her due date with our first child. And awesome. It's really exciting. My mother-in-law is down and everyone's kind of waiting. We were talking about it this morning is, we seem to have all, or they said they've all kind of relaxed a little bit and have eased into the idea of he may, may take him a little while to arrive. Right. But I don't know if I've relaxed. I'm still on edge, But it's like a duck where you look very calm, but underneath they're pedaling very fast.
Million miles feet. An hour. Yeah, dude. I remember the first one vividly, and ours was a very I think it's funny to tell the stories. But it's also not helpful because literally every child is different, even like in the same family, like could not have been two different experiences from the birth of the first to the birth of the second for us. Mm-hmm. Like in terms of how long it took, in terms of just the overall experience, it was night and day different, both great. But it was just like there's no way to know, And so like I remember that first one just being we're waiting and she was like, I think 11 or 12 days past her due date. And we're just like walking around like, okay, I mean, do I need to plan for 10 minutes from now? Because I don't know, like something could happen, but like you're kind of just living literally minute to minute. And it's so stressful for the first one. And then the second one came around, we're like, all right, well, when it happens, it happens. Like I'm going to go to the store, call me if you're going to labor. It's crazy.
Oh yeah. My wife has been great about, she's saying, don't change your plans, still go to the archery range. We still need to plan our lives. He's going to come when he's going to come. So
yep, totally.
She's such a rock star and, her mindset and the way she's approached the whole pregnancy as a whole, I think, and her background, she just got her second master's and it's in sports psychology and she's a fitness instructor. Nice. So
yeah,
we kind of talked about, which is, this is a little bit of an aside, but we talked about, from our backgrounds of training for perhaps like an event or a performance, we see that very clearly when it comes to perhaps, a lifting meet for a client or perhaps like a jiu-jitsu competition or maybe a 3D shoot or a hunt or something like that. We understand that, but I haven't heard many people refer to or talk about pregnancy in that way. Totally, and that was something that my wife and I talked about early on and this idea of you're preparing for a very physically and mentally challenging event.
Yes.
And the process of that is almost like training. And so the idea of maintaining your fitness and mental health and your diet and all of those things, it's kind of a cool and interesting way to approach that process of pregnancy. And I think because of that, that's why she's been able to continue to exercise all the way through 40 weeks.
Yeah.
And using some of the tools she's gained through her education and also as an instructor. I feel like we kind of do a disservice sometimes to pregnant women in that way, where we are not looking at what they're doing as something just so impressively athletic, for lack of a better term. And I think that it really is. And I think the idea of thinking of it that way is really powerful and kind of it enables our wives or enables these women rather than as like, well, I hope you make it through it.
Right.
We would never train for anything else in that manner.
Yeah,
we would
totally.
Never prepare for anything in that way that we wanted to be successful at. And it's kind of cool we've approached it that way. So
That's awesome.
Yeah, she did so many steps the last 2 days. She's walking 1 foot down on the curb, 1 foot up, bouncing on the ball.
Done all the things.
Yep. Ate the spicy food, the pineapple, yep. You know, all of it. So she's
funny.
Yeah.
I think the first one, with our first one, he was born in the first week of June. And same thing with my wife. Like, she trained and, like, lifted weights, not just, you know, did light walking type stuff. Like, she actually trained hard and did everything all the way through just a couple of days prior to him being born. And because he was born, the due date was like the last week of May or whatever. And it actually fell on the due date that time fell on Memorial Day that year. And she goes to a CrossFit gym that she's been going to for 4 or 5 years now. And, you know, obviously Memorial Day, everybody's doing Murph that whole day. And she obviously scaled it extremely far back just from what movements she was. I mean, she wasn't doing actual pull-ups. She was doing ring rows. She was doing, you know, elevated push-ups. She was doing assault bike or, you know, stuff. Like, she wasn't out running the whole time like that. But she did Murph, technically on her due date, which is just like the greatest thing. I always, every time I get the chance to bring up, I'm like, yeah, my wife did Murph on her due date. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, yeah, she did. And that's what happens when you can actually train and stay consistent through that whole process, like you said, and looking at it like an event to train for. Mm-hmm. Was the exact same thing that we did too. And so it was more like, okay, you know, you got, you know, we can quote it how much time is left, but, you know, we got 8 weeks till game time, you know, eight to nine weeks till game time. Like, got to start training like that's the case. It's been crazy to see how that, and it's cool that you guys are going through that too, especially on the first one, having that good experience with it. Cause that's going to make a big difference. You know, there's a lot of ways that we can go to start this, and pregnancy was not the way I thought we would spend the first 7.5 minutes, yeah. But I'm glad we did.
We're here now,
but, I want to continue on with the strength training side of things. Cause we're kind of in this right now. You do a lot of the starting strength methodology type stuff. You actually were just down doing some kind of clinic recently, I think. Correct? Was that a starting strength clinic that you were down at a couple weeks back?
Yeah. So every 2 years, to maintain my certification, we're required to audit one of the seminars.
Oh, okay.
And so when you initially test in the method, there's a practical portion of the exam.
Yep.
And that's completed at the seminar. And essentially, you're showing your ability to go through the teaching methods for all of the major lifts.
Yep.
And then also your ability to essentially get a lifter to move closer to the model of the movement that's presented within the method.
Sure.
And then as a part of like continued education or making sure that you are still up to the required level on the knowledge, every 2 years we just go attend the seminar. And that was down in Wichita Falls, Texas, which is where Ripito is at in the Wichita Falls Athletics Center. And so it's a 2.5-day seminar.
So I always like this avenue, because I know a handful, not many, but I know a handful of guys that are, you know, ingrained in the starting strength methodology. And it's a very specific one. So like, if you ever talk to somebody who's a starting strength coach, and then you like they program for you, or you hear them or watch them coach, if you know what it is, you could probably point them out just by watching them talk or listening to them talk, you know what I mean? And so I'm always curious, like, what the path was to find that as like, this is the thing that I believe in, right? Because I mean, there's no shortage of different ways to teach squat, ways to teach any of these movements. And many of them are great, right? It's not like there's the only thing, even though mechanically there are ways that can be more efficient if you're trying for ultimate strength, right? Or, you know, depending on what the goal is. But I'm always curious, like, what was the path that led you to starting strength as being the, ooh, this is my thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, such a great question. So I was fully embedded in doing jiu-jitsu at the time.
Okay.
And I had been doing, I guess, what we would call functional training with a coach in the area who was working with a lot of fighters at the time. And then there was a mixture of grapplers and MMA fighters. And I had gotten mixed in with that group and was attending class with them. And this coach I was working with, awesome guy, his name's Corey Beasley, and using a lot of what I guess we would call like odd object work.
Yeah.
And so barrels with sand and water, sandbags, kettlebells. He was big on crawling, a lot of different crawling variations. dragging trains or chains rather, pushing sleds, things like that.
A lot of strongman type stuff.
Yeah. I think like a lot of, you know, what I would refer to now as like engine development stuff.
Sure.
That also had some strength elements, you know, within that, but always, I think the biggest thing was building the engine and then seeing how much work could be done or capacity could be built for these people that are trying to also maintain a weight class. Hmm. And so I was doing that and I was doing a ton of jiu-jitsu. I was training at Art of Jiu-Jitsu in Costa Mesa, which for people that are not familiar is owned by Gi and Hoffa Mendez, who were multiple time world champions in the Gi. And then Hoffa was also two-time ADCC champion in the featherweight division. And I had started training there to rewind a little bit. I started training there shortly after they had opened in 2012. And to come back to what happened to me and got me into starting strength is I hurt my back.
Okay.
And there wasn't really a specific event that I can remember. I just remembered it getting progressively worse over time. And what had happened once I finally got an MRI is I had extruded my L5-S1 disc, which means that my disc had broken and then some of the fluid within the disc had pushed out into the canal and was pressing against the nerve, causing extreme sciatica.
Yeah.
And so I had tried a lot of various, you know, recovery methods and different, like, you know, some acupuncture, chiropractor, stretching. Yeah. I was going to OC Fight Doc, who is this doctor down here that sees all the fighters in the area and getting put on the rack, essentially, and getting stretched out and doing all those type of things. Well, I ended up finally choosing to have the procedure, which was an L5-S1 discectomy, which is essentially just a removal of that portion of the disc that is pressing against the nerve. And I got really lucky. I had this incredible doctor who worked on athletes, Dr. Wolf in Marina Del Rey. And I walked out of the hospital that same day. And wow. I hadn't stood up straight in a couple months. And I stood up ramrod straight and walked right out. But from that point forward, I think for anyone that has gone through a surgery like that or had what I would describe as almost inescapable pain where you can't move into a position where you can get away from it.
Yep.
I really wanted to essentially buttress myself from ever having that happen again.
Sure.
And my dad by trade is a physical therapist. And as a kid, when I was in high school and when I was coming up playing football, we were doing compound movements and, you know, kind of like old school barbell stuff. You know, I was doing hang cleans with him and squats and bench press and things like that. And through high school, when I was playing football in the gym, I was doing my best to squat and do those compound movements as well. And so I had this desire to go back to that. And so I kind of did a quick Google search and I found strong lifts 5x5.
Yep.
And so I remember I got a membership at one of the local, you know, big box gyms, and I walked in and I picked some arbitrary weight. It was probably something, doesn't matter what it was, but it was light. And I did the 5x5 squats and absolutely crushed myself. And I was sore for a bunch of days. And so I was like, man, there's got to be something easier. And I found starting strength and it was 3 sets of 5. And I was like, well, that must be easier. So
it's less.
I'll do that. You know, it's less. So it must be easier. Right. And so initially I was doing it on my own. And I think like most of us, I'm not a great dabbler. That's something that I don't do very well. So you'll see the blue book is behind me right there.
Yeah.
I got the blue book, which is the starting strength book. I was reading the book. I was keeping a training log. I was doing all of the to the best I could, the linear progression, which is the novice linear progression, as best as I could myself. And then a friend of mine who is actually a high level Muay Thai competitor and is a high level Muay Thai coach, and Bryce Krause, who's down in Costa Mesa area. He was like, hey, I know a guy who has a gym and teaches that method in Costa Mesa, and it's the Strength Co. And so I signed up there and I did what they call the intro to barbells. And I quickly learned that I was missing a lot of the intricacies of the technique that I thought that I was hitting. And so I signed up there and I started training, and because of my background in coaching and because I had been coaching jiu-jitsu already for many years, and I saw for myself the way that the method worked very methodically and was easy to track, because you know, as I tell new lifters, if we're tracking data, we want to keep as many constants as we can, at least right. initially in the novice phase of training. So we do that by having consistent range of motion, using the same movements over and over again, keeping our sets and reps as a constant, and then our variable, at least initially, is just going to be the weight on the bar. And that really kind of was something that was easy for my mind to understand and I really liked. And I think Grant Brogy, who's the owner of the Strength Co., he saw that I was really interested in the method and was studying on my own. And also because I had a background in coaching already, he offered me an internship at the gym. And initially I said no. Mm-hmm. So I said no. And I was like, hey, I want to complete the novice linear progression first before I consider anything like that. I want at least like 6 to 9 months of training underneath my belt before I commit to doing something like that. And then he came around again and asked me again. I think that was encouraging for him because he always talks about skin in the game. He really loves people that have skin in the game.
Yep.
And because I think responded by saying, no, I want to have more skin in the game before I do this. Then when I accepted the next time, we were full steam ahead. And then I began coaching. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, so you came into it from you did the method, like you used it rather than having a bunch of coaching experience in training specifically. Like, and then kind of settling in, realizing, ooh, this is the one that kind of fits most with me. Like, you came into it from essentially kind of the underside. And, like, mm-hmm. I experienced how this benefited what I was looking for exactly and were able to tie it into all the things that you needed at the time. And so I think that's a cool way to come up into it.
Yeah, because I think for me, part of it was, like I said, the recovery from the back surgery and wanting mm-hmm. to... I had this very clear theory of I wanted to build strength as like essentially building armor so that I wouldn't re-injure myself in that way again.
Yeah.
Simultaneously, you know, I'm 6'1" and okay. I had originally fought in the lightweight division, which is 168 with the gi on. And so I was cutting down to low 160s to compete, and that's pretty skinny for 6'1".
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, somewhere in my mind, I think I had a realization that low amount of muscle mass was having an impact on my joints and having an impact on my overall bumps and bruises and injuries and things sure. like that. And then the other half of that is I became incredibly attracted to big guy style games, in particular people like Buchecha, Hodger Gracie, Bernardo Faria, all those type of styles of game. And really part of it was I had the great fortune of getting to go to Hawaii with Ruka is essentially like a surf brand, but they also mm-hmm. have a lot of history within MMA and jiu-jitsu. And I got to train a little bit with Buchecha and learn from him and some other awesome people as well. And I was like, gosh, I really enjoy this style of game. And I was, you know, already in my early mid 30s at the time and kind of seeing the longevity of certain styles of play of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And needing to transition to what I call more of like a working class style of jiu-jitsu is the way that I would like to describe it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if I want to play big guy jiu-jitsu, I should be a big guy. And it was really kind of that simple. And so I started the process and I think I went from roughly, because after I had my surgery, I got all the way down to like the 150s. It was really, really thin. And then by the time I finished like my first 18 months of training in the method, I got up to almost 215 pounds.
That's quite the swing.
That's quite the swing, right? So we're talking almost 60 pounds roughly of gain. And then now I've settled back down to where I kind of hover in the 190s to low 200s, sure. depending on what my eating's like and what my training schedule is like.
So this block of time, when you're figuring all this out, how far into jiu-jitsu are you at this point? Like, have you been doing it for a long time prior to this? And then you're like, this is all these things are changing. I'm changing how I train. I'm now going to change my style of jiu-jitsu. Like, where is in the jiu-jitsu history for you this point in time we're talking about?
I think I was pretty deep into blue belt at the time.
Okay.
By the time that I had the injury occur.
Yep.
And then I had come back and started training. And then, you know, I didn't start the barbell training immediately after coming back.
Sure.
I was still trying some other methods prior to thinking about getting big and strong, or rather bigger and stronger than I was, not right. big and strong in general, but bigger and stronger than I was. And then I also think it correlated well in a sense, because as I have friends that train and people that I talk to, and I think as you move into purple belt and beyond, you know, there are certain things that I believe the player hopefully is beginning to organize the style of play that they want to have. Yep. And I oftentimes will talk about removing seams or gaps within their style of play so that their game becomes much tighter or much more, I like to say, coherent or cohesive. And so as I was progressing through getting stronger and gaining weight, I was also transitioning into using some external resources to learn from as well. Because, you know, Gui and Rafa Mendes are absolute geniuses, but they're also known for a very specific style of play. And they're also smaller men, right? And sure. they understand every style of play. It's not that they don't understand things like half guard or, right. you know, things like that.
Right.
But, you know, they're really the masters of the creation of the modern De La Hiva guards and Barambolo and thing like that, yep. things like that, for those yep. that are familiar. And so that was really when I also began to like outsource, you know, trying to learn from people like Paul Schreiner, who I think is, for those that have never heard of him, I believe is probably the best American coach there is. Mm. His way of teaching, his way of understanding concepts and techniques is absolutely incredible. And then I was also looking at the actual players who were successful within competition. And so people, like I said, like Buchecha, obviously, Bernardo Faria, Hodger Gracie. And that was how, so as you're transitioning through purple belt and definitely into brown, it's not that I think you aren't open to learning new techniques or aren't open to changing your game, but I would definitely say that at that point, you should have some idea of how you want to express yourself through your jiu-jitsu. Mm. And that's through the style of play that you find. I think it's a combination of, personally, I would say it's a combination of a couple of things. One is your age and athleticism. And that's something that I would recommend the person take a very sober look at.
Yeah.
Right. So you may really want to play the inverted game or Barambolo, but if, you know, no disrespect, but if you're in your 40s and you have a lifetime of sport and you're somewhat banged up, that may be something you want to reconsider. And so being very honest about that first, and then deciding a style of play that matches your anthropometry, the way that your body is organized, and then looking at the people that have excelled in that type of style of play, and then using all those elements to then try to form what you're doing. That was, I think, that process is when I really started to have the most fun. And also when I was playing what I consider like my best jiu-jitsu, where I really felt like I was doing what I wanted to do, was as I transferred through that process and began playing a style that was better fit to my age, my athleticism at the time, and also like what things I found to be interesting or effective.
When you started in your, or maybe even around this same time where you're going through all this, as you start to progress in jiu-jitsu, were you someone who right away like got hooked in, you're like, I'm gonna see this through all the way to black? Or were you in like, this is just something I need to do to maintain this specific skill, and I'm just gonna, you know, if it ends up there, great. Because I know that's a lot of people kind of go down one of those two roads, you know, the ones that stick with it anyways. They're like, you know, this is a thing that I like to do a couple times a week to keep me sharp in this area, and you know, if it takes me, you know, I was just talking to a guy the other day who had a guy at his gym that got his black belt after like 27 years going one day a week, mm-hmm. you know, and like there's guys like that. Or you go the complete other way. You're like, I'm in this for the, you know, for all these things that I want to do competitively. Maybe it's like actually competing in meets and fights and all this kind of stuff. Where were you along that when you started, and did it change like as you got into mm-hmm. it farther?
Yeah, I am envious of people that can set a 2 day a week or 3 day a week standard for themselves and maintain it for a really, really long period of time. Mm-hmm. I think that slowly I'm growing better at that now that I'm 40 years old, understanding that less is more a lot of times. Mm. But at that point, I was 28 years old. I think I signed up for 2 or 3 days a week, and that lasted maybe a month to 2 months. And then I was like, well, I'm going full time. And then I was training multiple times a day. I was wanting to attend competition class.
Yeah.
And then, you know, shortly after getting my blue belt, I was asked if I wanted to coach kids class. So then I was coaching the young kids class also in the academy. And then, so I was fully in and I felt very committed from early on. Also, I got really bad cauliflower early on, like as a white belt. And so I remember one of the guys, he was like, well, you have to get a black belt now.
Yeah. And now you're in.
You have to get a black belt because you're in. Your ear's destroyed. So
you can't
do that. You
can't have this going one day a week.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was coaching kids, and then I would say like the bulk of my competition occurred through blue and purple belt. And then as I began to teach adult basics, the competition side, at least for myself, it really began to lessen, and I pretty much stopped competing and was really focused on teaching at that point. I was really passionate about coaching beginning adults because that's how I started. I started in my late 20s and into my 30s.
Yeah.
And so
same here.
Really trying to think about also the method of coaching, because, and there are some fantastic schools with excellent instructors, but I did not want to be a coach that walked on and said, hey, we're going to learn this movement today without context, without understanding what got us here or where we go after. And I think there are a lot of old school places, and some of them were amazing, but some of them, the teacher they had teaching that day is working on a certain choke, or he has something he's figuring out. And so he walks in and says, we're going to do this technique today.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky because the way that the Mendez brothers teach is everything was within sequence.
Yes.
Everything was how did we get here? Where are we going? What are the other person's choices or options from these positions? And that was really the way that I tried to teach my white belts and some blue belts that stayed with me on the small mat.
Yeah.
And I think what it did for me is when I was training was it allowed me to then on my own begin to think about, okay, what comes next here? How do I work through this process of this, you know, when they stop me here, or when I run into a blockade, what are my other choices? And so that was really what I tried to focus on within my teaching of adult basics.
That's very similar concept, and it's very similar conceptually and practically for how I've learned since two and a half years now that I've been since I've started. And the way that my professor teaches very much along that same line, where it's like, yeah, we're going to practice this one thing, but you also need to know the six things that come before that to get to this point. Otherwise, learning this part doesn't really matter. You know, like everybody wants to know these cool finishing, these finishing submissions or like all these passes or all this, but it's like, you have to understand the whole system of what got you to this point. And then even like all the things that come after that too, it's like, okay, you got, you did the thing. And if it's not a submission and you're still, maybe it's a pass or something like that, it's like, okay, now what, you know, you have to, cause what good does it do to teach you a pass? And then you don't know what to do after you've passed the guy. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Or if your pin is, you know, your pin position, whatever your preferred one is of low quality, then the pass could be the coolest long step or knee slide or Toreando ever. But if you have a low quality side control, or, you know, and you're getting bounced right out, then it kind of, we need to understand the importance of those other pieces of the puzzle as we're staging through these like small skirmishes, you know, as we're passing, as Dan Hurt talks about, like different joint lines of the body.
Yeah.
And we're moving up, you know, toward our submission at, you know, hopefully, but it needs to be set first by a quality pin. And I think like you were saying is working your way backwards and forwards through those progressions is really the way to find the places within your game where you can make tweaks and adjustments. Because, you know, we're getting so deep on jiu-jitsu, this is awesome, but let's say that I like a certain type of guard to play.
Yep.
And I like a certain type of sweep, but then the pass I like uses completely different grips than the sweep I like.
Right.
And there's a little bit of incoherence there. Is it necessarily wrong? I wouldn't say it's necessarily wrong, but a good player is going to watch you change your grips, and that's where they are going to find the space and they are going to begin to return. Now, if you have so if you're willing to kind of change the piece that comes before or after, so maybe you really love this guard and the sweep and you're using perhaps like a pant and a sleeve grip.
Yep.
Then maybe you're willing to learn how to leg drag off of that. Or maybe you're willing to learn how to do some other techniques off of that, rather than, as a lot of young players really do, is they get on top and they immediately let go and they're gripping all over the body and changing grips. And those are areas where we can really like tighten the game and make you much more difficult to deal with if we're looking at coherence. I also think another piece of that is, and cut me off whenever you want.
Oh,
I'll
man.
Stop
going
on about this.
You keep going.
Is like, if I know that I prefer a certain type of pin, or let's say I prefer to take the back, right? If I prefer to take the back, then I'm going to probably want to pass to leg drag rather than to side control. If I want to be someone that sweeps before I take the back, or you would be, if you don't want to sweep before you take the back, you would be entering into like those methods of the Barambola or the inverted game to take the back prior to sweeping and coming on top and getting points. But if you like to take the back, but you're going to mount every time, you can still take the back from there for sure. But it would, you know, those are little things that you can ask yourself and think about. Where do I like to submit from? Oh, I like to submit from side control. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want a pass that gives me a high quality side control, and I want to sweep in a way that links me directly to my pass. And I think that's a very, I didn't realize that till much later in my, in my growth and knowledge, especially as a coach or as a player myself. And I think those are little things that if you can start to think about that early on, I don't necessarily think that someone who's at a blue or purple belt has to say, this is my game, this is what I have to be playing. But I think whatever the structure is or system is that you're using at the time, asking yourself those questions can really help you eliminate those gaps where the person you're playing against is going to be able to find space and attack.
Everything is essentially a setup to something else, even if it never concludes in the direction you think. Like, you always have the option of going essentially infinite different ways, as long as you understand what those different ways are. Like, this setup can go here, but if I go here, now this sets up three different things that it wouldn't have unless if I went the other way coming back a second ago. You know, like, it's always a giant spider web of stuff. And I think that's what, like, the coolest part has been as I've practiced and understood more than I have previously. Like, each time it's like, not only do I have moments where I understand the specific thing, but it's like, I understand what this means three steps from now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think that's where, like you said, if you can get to those points and begin to even build sort of this like game that suits how you like to play, body type, like speed, strength, all these kind of things, you can kind of begin to craft this little thing. And I was trying to remember who I had heard. It might've been my professor Sam that made the analogy in some comparable way, and I'll probably butcher how he said it, but it's kind of like when you get to these areas where you're starting to put stuff together on your own, right? It's essentially like learning a musical instrument to a degree. Like, you can't start soloing over stuff before you understand what scales are in the notes. Like, you have to understand how to do the foundational stuff. Once you got that down, now it's like, now you can start to play with these little fun intricacies of things after you get to a certain point. And that's when, like you say, and you get to this point where I understand this, how can I suit this a little bit better to me personally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the other half of that, which is when it gets the most fun, is, and we'll back to this idea of like data gathering, is if you're playing the certain set of positions, every role, you're going to slowly begin to know all of the other person's options.
Yeah.
So at certain points, you're going to get into your passing position of where you work your passing system from, let's say, and you're going to know all of their options for defense against your A pass, let's say your sharpest sword. And so based on you knowing all those choices, then you have this cool decision tree. And then that allows you to continue to work through your other options there, because not only have you over time developed a system that is your main pass and then other offshoots of passes that can be used from that position based on defenses, you also know all of their choices. And that's where it becomes really, I think, the most fun and most enjoyable is, you know, you're playing a position where you know all of those choices. And then you can see when you get beat in class or you get beat in a competition, then it's not so disheartening because now you've gathered more data and you're like, oh, that's interesting. He attacked my half guard this way and he neutralized my underhook this way. And then you can go back to your drawing board, so to say, or ask another training partner or your professor. And then they can tell you like the little key that's going to make that adjustment so you can neutralize that. And that's, I think, when it gets like, I like to say the most delicious and fun. It's when it gets really, really fun and exciting.
So you mentioned that the competing part kind of waned for you in interest a little bit, but do you compete at all anymore or are you done with that part of stuff?
So I'm not also like to, for full disclosure, I'm not training currently. Yeah. So I don't train in jiu-jitsu currently. I don't want to pretend as if I am. All of my focus has kind of transitioned into archery and then the barbell coaching and lifting. And my competition focus has kind of shifted into shooting 3Ds. And then I have some goals within that I want to do. But I think within jiu-jitsu, when I stopped, it was, to be very honest, I was not enjoying the process of competition training. I was not enjoying at that time in my life, I wasn't, I think, capable of being in that mode mentally and physically and then shifting off afterward.
Sure.
And so that was when I transitioned just into coaching and was getting much more enjoyment out of that. And then just kind of training with my peers and my buddies and training hard in class. But I remember very clearly one day I was in competition class and Guy Mendez said, if you want to have fun, go to fundamentals. And I was like, in my head, I was like, I do want to have fun.
I do. That sounds nice.
And so, you know, I think I'm very fortunate to have seen the way that world champions train. And I got to be in the room watching them and to see the Mendez brothers, to see Keenan Cornelius or Andre Galvo and some of these, the Meow brothers when they were brown belts, and to watch them train and how they do it and the absolute full dedication to that process. It was incredible and it was really valuable, I think, to train in that really hard way for a short period of time. But I also knew for myself, it wasn't something that I wanted to continue to do.
Sure.
I got my black belt and it was incredible. And I was, my friend Justin and I were the first two people to go from white belt to black belt underneath the Mendez bros.
Oh, that's cool.
And very fortunate to have done that and learned from them. Shortly after that, everything closed down because of COVID.
Gotcha.
And everything stopped. And so I was to transition into the archery stuff.
Yeah.
Everything was shut down and we weren't getting to train and I wasn't teaching, obviously. And so I was looking for something to do. And we can get into like my family history and stuff too regarding hunting and all of those things. But that was kind of the space where I had wanted to get back into archery and I had that space now because everything was shut down. And so that was what got me back into it. And since then has kind of like become my, I think Drew talked about it a week ago, being obsessed with archery.
Yeah.
You know, and I am that person.
Did you go straight to traditional or did you, did you? So you, again, another thing where you just jump in the deep end on something like that, that requires a lot of, I don't even know the word because focus just doesn't seem to be enough. You know what I mean? Like, because there's so many, and it's one of the things I think is so cool about traditional archery is the fact that it's so simple to a degree, like not easy, simple. Like you have a stick and a string and an arrow. Like there's nothing in yourself, right?
Yeah.
Everything that goes wrong is 99% going to be the shooter, right? Like there's very little times where it's ever going to be the weapon in that scenario. You know what I mean? And so that's what I think is cool because it requires a level of deep focus into every little position, every little everything to be repeatable with a good shot. And it's like, I have yet to find in shooting relative, you know, in shooting world, something that's that way. Like I shot compound bows for a couple of years and I got, you know, I would say proficient enough out to, you know, 50 yards where I'm like, I don't know why I'd shoot farther than this anyways. Like I feel good at 50 shooting, you know, a baseball sized target, you know what I mean? But it's like, and Brandon told the story, a handful of times, and I'm pretty sure it was, Tom Clum Sr. who had told him this once where he had said, you know, like when you shoot, with a compound bow, you like, you expect it to be so precise and accurate that when you shoot one arrow outside a silver dollar, you're like ticked because something went wrong. Right. And he's like, but if you're shooting a recurve bow and you hit three on a pie plate, you're calling your friends. It's like the best day ever. Like you're just totally dialed in. And I'm like, oh, yeah. I like that mental approach to it a lot more, I think, because so I'm curious, like, do you experience it, or did you experience it kind of the same way when you came into the traditional world?
I think that, you know, because of my childhood and because my dad is a diehard traditional bow hunter.
Yeah.
And so there's probably an air of stubbornness that was never going to allow me to not shoot a traditional bow. You know, and to be quite honest, probably some of that is like, as I say, like chasing a ghost, right?
Yeah.
My dad and I are like estranged, okay, and we haven't talked in a long time. And so, you know, as some of us do, some of it is probably like, well, I'm going to be better at this than my dad, you know? And I have to, that is something that I have to sift through and ask myself often, what is the real reason for this pursuit? Is it to just like, is there a part of me that's that kid saying, I want to shake him and get his attention, essentially? Yeah. Or how much of it is for my own pursuit and simply my desire to see how far I can take this simple stick and string and how proficient can I get? To go back to what you were saying about being a part of the process, Cody Greenwood, he says, you know, as you begin to move down in these decisions about the weapon you use, you're just choosing to become a bigger part of the process. And so if you're shooting a rifle, like you're that. A certain part of the process, and then you move into a compound and you're a greater part of the process. And then, you know, the guys who are shooting self bows or shooting ASLs, American semi long bows, right? I would kind of argue they're an even bigger part of the process than if you're shooting like, and which I think are incredible bows, but let's say I'm shooting like a ILF rig that is weighted and has really good ability to reduce torque or to reduce variables within tiller, right? If I'm shooting a bow made out of one piece of wood,
yeah,
I've now become an even bigger factor because my tool has been limited even more.
Sure.
And I also, like, in a funny way, it's also like your desire to like suffer, I guess, you know, to suffer through this process of, I really want to, my wife and I use this term all the time, like encounter myself. I want to encounter myself within this process. And that can be so uncomfortable. Why can't I do this process the same every single time? Why can't I let myself let go of the aim, for example, which is something like Joel Turner talks about. Why can't I get off the aim and focus on my expansion or whatever it is? And I think that's like the magic of it is really that struggle there in that moment where, you know, and I think honestly, you can find the same thing within compound. You know, if you're someone that punches the trigger with a compound bow and you're fighting really hard to force yourself to shoot a surprise release, man, that's not easy. That's incredibly difficult. I think, you know, just when you transition to, and also I think, you know, if you look at Bodie Turner, he's shooting 330 X's, you know, hitting the X 30 times, which is a dime at 18 meters. I don't care that he's shooting a compound with a stabilizer and a magnifier and all that type of stuff.
Crazy,
it's absolutely incredible. The amount of mental fortitude to do that.
Yeah.
We as traditional archers could learn a lot from that.
Yeah.
I think also as traditional archers, we could learn a lot about the way that compound shooters organize their shot or organize the steps of their shot or the process of their shot. But I think to go back to why is I really want to be as big a part of this process as possible. And the struggle of that to continue to kind of, and there are much better shooters than me and a lot of people I really admire and I look up to. But some mentors of mine have, or a mentor in particular of mine has challenged me like, hey, why don't you try shooting an ASL? Why don't you try, you know, wood arrows, you know,
I just saw you've been messing with those the last few days.
Yeah. And so I finally got the courage up to do that because it just seemed so daunting to me. Sure. But I think, you know, part of it is being a child that grew up within that and my dad, you know, always loving to shoot a longbow and shooting wood arrows and all that type of stuff. And I want to pay homage to that. So there's probably these like a devil and an angel on each shoulder. I want to pay homage to that, but I also want to be, you know, you know, every son wants to beat their dad essentially. Yeah. Right. And then also for my own of like, oh, how far can I take this process? How much can I learn about myself within this process? You know, and also I think like something I wanted to say was I'm definitely, I guess, like an archer who hunts. And I think that's something that, because I can really feel very lacking at times with my lack of knowledge. And there are a lot of things that I don't have a great knowledge base in. I don't think I have the field craft or the understanding of all these things that these excellent backcountry hunters have. And I'd be lying if I said I did. The part that I've focused on in, you know, in these 3.5 years since I started shooting a bow is really on my proficiency, trying to gain as much proficiency as I can within shooting the bow. And then these moments of trying to shoot under pressure, whether that is at a 3D shoot or a shoot off to see who gets first or second, or whether it's on an animal. I think for me, that's really been the thing where I really am seeking and searching that out. And I think others, and I admire it a lot, are seeking it out through 14 days in the backcountry or whatever those things could be. But I don't want to be misleading and say that that's where my skill set is or that's what I am doing. You know, to be very clear, like pretty much all of my hunts have been either through an outfitter or with a guide.
Sure.
or on a ranch.
Yeah.
And those skill sets required for that are very different. And I really admire those guys that do all that. But the things that I'm seeking to do are just slightly different.
Those moments of, you know, putting yourself in that headspace for, can I make this shot in this moment, right? Like you mentioned the example of I'm doing a shoot off in a competition, or there's these things, or, you know, you have all these different ways of sort of creating this environment, mental environment, right? Like you can actually be drawn back on a living thing. You can be in a competition for this. When you go into those places, what sort of things are you doing mentally or even maybe physically, like to make sure you stay centered and don't get yips or blow it in those scenarios? Like, have you developed sort of a mental practice or a physical practice to make sure, like, when you get to that time, it's like, I'm not going to waste it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a great question. I think we're so lucky to have resources, for example, like The Push. And for anybody that's listening that is interested in learning about traditional archery, I cannot recommend them enough and the resources they have, especially through their online coursework and through the podcast. It was probably the number one resource that led me to becoming competent as quickly as I've been able to. And being able to have success in whatever that means of on animals or relatively like within, you know, shooting 3D shoots or shooting proficiency. Is really like, I can't thank Matt and Tim enough. And also those coaches that they gathered together to provide that information. Early on, I really leaned heavily on listening to their episodes of Coaching Moments. And then also seeking out those coaches that they refer to, like Tom Clum Sr., as you mentioned, and Joel Turner. And I really, I had the huge benefit of attending an immersion clinic with them in Texas. And that was really a big kind of turning point, because as we know, as coaches, we can do a good job online and we can do our best to convey things through online coaching. And I think if you can't see one of those coaches in person, online is an incredible option. And the PAT courses on the push are an incredible option. But it's not the same as Joel standing right here and looking at you and watching you try to get through your process. And he's telling you if you're not. And there's 13 other guys standing around watching you shoot. And I think that's really where you get to have that moment of it being revealed, of your ability to stay in the process. And the same thing with Tom. And, you know, Tom has this great way of, for those that have, you know, had the opportunity to be coached by him, is, you know, he's so good at disarming you and saying, hey, whatever you've done, I've done it way worse. Don't worry. You know, we're going to get you in alignment. We're going to teach you how to shoot under increasing tension, and we're going to make this happen, you know. And his ability to calm the student down, I think, is such a skill of his that we don't talk about enough. He has an incredible amount of technical understanding, but his ability to be kind of like that dad or grandpa who's just like, hey, let me, you know, help you with this. It really allows you to, I think, excel in those moments of being coached by him. But when it comes down to those moments of shooting under pressure, I really, you know, have bought in, and I don't want to sound like a Joel Turner salesman,
sure,
but I really bought into this process of learning how to separate from the aim and stay within the process of the shot and stay within whatever is, as they say, like the shot activation movement. And I'm someone that runs a trigger within my shot. Yep. And we can discuss that too, if you want to, or talk about what
that
means.
Do you do a clicker string, or do you do like the trigger on the riser itself?
Yeah. So I push on my tab actually. So I shoot a tab made by this company Yoast, and their face on their tab, I probably should have grabbed it, but it's like a little metal piece on the back of the tab.
Yep.
And I hook my thumbnail onto the edge of the tab, and then I press through it like a trigger, essentially, like you're pulling a hammer back on a pistol or a rifle or something like that.
Yep.
And so that's the process that I go through to shoot that. I was inspired to try that method because of Dan Collins. He was extremely successful shooting that method, went and shot at the 3D Worlds. And then Joel's been using a tabs here also. So it's something that I've learned to use over time, but, I think, you know, this, as Joel talks about, when you're in these moments of executing this movement pattern, or in other sports, it is different because there's not an explosion that's going to occur, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a bow, there's this big release, or especially with a traditional bow, there's a huge release of energy that occurs within your body. And that's very off-putting. And your body wants to time it, and your body wants to know when that's going to go off. And I think there's not much, you know, or not many things as powerful as making that choice of like, I'm going to run this process and allow this explosion to go off as a surprise. Mm. And if you can do that, I think you have the power to, as I joke with my wife all the time, like refill the ice cube dish, even when I don't feel like it, you know?
Yeah.
Or if I walk by dishes in the sink and I can talk myself through, I'm going to wash those dishes in the sink right now, or whatever it is. And I think that process of like, if you can make yourself run a shot under control, let a shot go off as a surprise, there's a lot of other stuff you can force yourself to do. It reminds me, the only thing it really reminds me of that's as stressful or as challenging is the moments before the ref calls you in to come to the mat in a jiu-jitsu match.
Yeah.
And you're watching the clock run down on the match before you, and you're standing there behind the scorekeeper, and your friends have come over to stand behind the railing, and you're like fixing your belt again for the 100th time, and you are trying to, like, you feel like you're in a dream, or at least I did, where you can't move your body as well as you want to. And then you choose to step out there and do it. That's the only other thing I could really compare it to. The feeling, especially of drawing back on an animal with a traditional bow and choosing, making that choice to like take a shot. So I think like that's really the magic of it, and also the frustration of it, and why it's such a struggle. And you and Brandon and everyone else that does this understands it. It's a day-to-day, there's this day-to-day changing and aliveness of the process of, is my bow arm good today, or my grip, or my fingers on the string? Mm-hmm. And then And then all of those are factors as well, and they must be paid attention to. And it's not that they don't matter. The form matters a ton, but it can also blow up when you get to the point of, I'm going to release this arrow on this 3D target in front of all my buddies, or on this animal because I want to make an ethical shot, or it's my first animal, or whatever it is for you. And that's really where I find that this huge attraction is this process of, like, can I control myself under pressure? Do I have the ability to execute my process and stay in a present process thinking state in this moment where it's a moment of, like, high personal value?
Yeah. It's one of the only, and you made the analogy to, like, that moment prior to a jiu-jitsu match. Coming from athletics myself, like, I think there's been several analogies I could make in that same way, but it's one of the only things that I can think of in my life where everything around me shuts off. You know what I mean? Like, in that moment, as soon as I start my drawback, like, it's almost like there's silence around me. I could have people talking and screaming. And I experienced this when I've sent you pictures and messaged you a couple times in the last few weeks when I started this 3D league that we do every week on Tuesday nights, which has been, like, super fun, because I have only once, when we were at Winter Strong last year, been in an environment where I'm shooting around other people. Like, every other time I shoot, I'm just in my backyard shooting at my bag target, you know? Mm-hmm. And so even just that adds a little something extra to, okay, let's make sure I'm dialed. I don't want to just send this 10 feet over a target in front of 20 people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a little bit of that, but there's always, but I realized in those league moments, like, we're all laughing, we're talking, we're having a good time. I go to pull back, there might as well not be anybody there. You know what I mean? Like, I can, it's one of the only things that I can, and playing music is probably the only other one that I've really experienced that same level of, it's almost meditation, right? It's like a moving meditation to a degree. Like, I can get going playing some music on a guitar and not realize that 35 minutes have gone by. Mm-hmm. And I can fire off arrows and be totally zoned into what I'm doing. And same thing, I look up, like, holy crap, I've been shooting for an hour. Like, mm-hmm. what is going on? Like, and I love it for that. And I think that's what the main difference was in it for me that gave me that, like, okay, this is something different in how I'm experiencing this actual activity. Not even just like, oh, this is cool, I'm getting, you know, another weapon I'm getting somewhat proficient at. It's like, no, this actually is doing something different to me personally. And that's why I like coming back to it.
Yeah. And I think the parallels and the reason that we enjoy all of these things so much, and I'm not a musician myself, but I love music. But even, let's say you're going to walk out a heavy squat and you're going to try to hit a, who knows, a new personal best for you. Now, if you allow a lot of thoughts to come in that moment, this is really heavy, I've never done this weight before, everyone's watching, I don't want to die, right? Because if you never put a squat on the pins before, for me, before I ever did that, I was like, well, I'm going to die. And so we'll just see what happens, right?
This is where it ends.
But if you can, to quote Joel again, if you can replace that with thinking or just your cues within that space, right? If you instead are, you know, telling yourself, take a big breath, brace, shove your knees out, reach your hips back, drive up. Now you're thinking through that process, and your thinking has, as he would say, has become louder than those thoughts that are coming in. In the same way, you know, the first time I competed in jiu-jitsu, I couldn't hear my coach. I was gasping like a fish out of water. I was staring at the ceiling of the Long Beach Pyramid, which is where they hold the worlds, you know, at this, it was just like a IBJJF open tournament. This guy is like absolutely smashed me, had knee on belly. And, but then slowly over time, I was able to lower the volume on the thoughts and increase the volume on my thinking. And I was never had a way to describe that until recently. Joel put words to that, what was occurring, but I was able to hear my coach in later tournaments. I was able to actually implement techniques in later tournaments or things like that. And all of these have such a parallel in that way. I imagine if you're playing a certain chord progression or a solo or something along those lines, and you allow some outside thought to travel in, I would find it hard to believe that you're going to still be able to play that correctly or play it the way that you need to. And the same thing goes when you're drawing back on an animal or shooting a very tough shot, you know, in a tournament or something like that. All those thoughts, we have to work really, really hard to make, to be thinking about what is actually going to make this thing go well. So how do I make myself think about staying in my process? Whatever the actual, it could be weightlifting, jiu-jitsu, shooting my bow, playing my instrument, you know, and I think that's where the big, that's where like that magic is of that battle of like, can I gain control over all of my defense mechanisms, everything that I've thought about myself or people have told me since I was a kid, and it's all coming crashing in right now in this moment of high personal value and stress. And am I able to push that away for this moment and be in my process and do what I need to do, which is the function of whatever makes that process be executed correctly. And that's, I think, like the magic of all of this, like that is that moment of encountering yourself and all of the, that self narrative or that false self narrative that perhaps has occurred within you. And we have, you know, we create this, we've chosen these moments of stress to then encounter that self narrative again. This is something my wife talks a lot about, is like, we train really hard so that this self narrative bubbles up and then it comes to like rear its ugly head. And then we get to decide how to deal with it. And that's really, I think, like what the huge value is in all of these things. I imagine that for these backcountry hunters that are doing, you know, 7, 10, 14 days and are hungry and tired and haven't seen an elk yet, you know, and don't have, maybe they're by themselves and they don't have somebody to talk to. They're encountering themselves too. I could only imagine what that's like. I don't know. I haven't done that. But part of that, part of why it's so life-changing, I would imagine, or why they want to go do it every year, is because you're having to, all that stuff is going to bubble up at some point and you're going to have to navigate it and deal with it and then take on a stock of things you need to work on or change.
I love it, man. That was kind of a good mic drop moment, if you ask me. I think that's a good place to wrap it up, man.
Okay.
Thank you for making time, dude. I mean, we could have done 3 more hours
if we,
you know what I mean? And maybe we'll have to do a part 2 when you guys get a little bit more settled in after baby's here.
Yeah.
But I know you're like we mentioned before, you're minute to minute life right now, essentially, which I love. Yeah. I'm so pumped for you guys.
Yeah, we didn't even get to talk about bands we like yet.
Oh, dude, we could do a whole 2 hours just on that. You know what I mean? And we might have to. We might have to make this more regular thing, obviously. But,
Cool. Dude,
thank you for making time, man. I had a blast getting to talk to you a little bit more, more in depth, obviously, than just the random IG messages every once in a while. So, dude, we'll definitely have to do it again. And why don't you, I mean, you got your personal page. That's been super fun to follow a lot of this stuff. So go ahead and plug that. And then, yeah, man, we'll wrap it up.
Okay. So I'm at Jeff_Hairston on Instagram. The gym I coach at is at the Strength Co. right here. They also make American-made plates and barbells and racks. So if you're looking for that, our owner, Grant Brogy, he's manufactured all that stuff in the U.S. That's about it. So
yeah,
thank you so
much.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you making time and we'll chat soon, brother.
All right. Thank you.